Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hi, and welcome to my podcast. I shouldn't say this, but my name is Katie Leeson and I'm Managing Director of Social Chain UK. This is the series finale of the podcast, and in this episode is my therapist, Karen. This is an extremely personal, extremely value-driven episode. Karen's going to solve the main problems that she gets as a therapist. We're going to talk about how anxiety is actually a good thing for society, and also things that we can all do to improve our mental health. I really, really, really can't wait for you to listen to this. Karen has been the inspiration for this podcast. She's had a massive impact on my life, and I can't wait for you all to hear it. So without further ado, here is episode 50, the end of season one of I Shouldn't Say This But. I'm super excited today because today I've got Karen, my therapist, on the podcast. I was talking before, and Dodds and I were talking about one of the reasons that we started the podcast was because of the sessions that we'd had.
Wow.
And the advice and help and the way we work through things to make me feel a lot more comfortable. Wow. So welcome, Karen.
Thank you so much.
Everyone's heard quite a lot about you, so it's nice to everyone to be able to listen to you as well now.
Good to be with everybody.
So I'd love to start with a little bit of a background on you, if that's okay.
Yes, that's absolutely fine, yeah.
So over to you.
Yes, so I think, you know, as a person, I've always erred towards people and always sort of thought about wanting to make a difference with people or help people, but I never really knew, you know, where my place was, so to speak. So in school, I was like, you know, you sort of get the feeling that you need a career, you need to know what you're doing. And I'm like, well, what do I do? You know, my dad is like a sort of businessman, and I do not feel like a business type person. And so I was thinking, you know, would it be the police? There was an idea of doing that. Would I be in the fire service? You know, and then when I was in university, I was training to be a teacher. But I decided that was not for me. Mm-hmm. And within the final sort of year of uni, I also started the first level of my counselling studies, because I've been working with some marginalised communities and young people who are involved in crime and antisocial behaviour. So I sort of got stuck into that, and it had been suggested to me quite a few times that maybe you should look at being a counsellor, because people tend to sort of gravitate towards me, you know, strangers. I could be sat on the bus, and at the end of the trip, I'll have someone's life story, or I'll be in the gym changing room and that's someone opening up to me. And I don't mind at all, you know, I really like talking to people. So, you know, some people are like, wow, you know, they can't understand that. But I really do, you know, love people and talking to them, and definitely helping to make improvements. So it was a natural sort of thing, and I'm really pleased I found my place.
And I think it mirrors a lot of people's career paths.
Yes,
like you don't really have a clue where you want to get to and how you want to get there until you
definitely
find your passion.
Yeah,
I guess
it can be quite a pressure actually as a young person as well to you know, I know you've as a company have sort of discussed that in the past, you know, in university, and supposed to be going to university and doing this, but, you know, how would you know at that age, really?
Yeah, that's so true. It's so true. So how long have you been a therapist for?
Yeah, so about 5.5 years now. In between the studies, which I'd done over about, quite a few years, actually, because I've studied quite a few different modalities. But it was all part-time, and I was working sort of in a corporate environment in finance, which, again, definitely not me, but I sort of fell into that. And with ease, you know, it sort of means to an end. And then when I finally qualified, I was like, right, I can get into this now.
You can do it on your own.
Yes, I can.
Amazing. So I don't know how long I've been seeing you for then now. Must be way over a year. And I know from personal experience that it is a little bit, when you first think about going, it's that...
Definitely.
A bit scary. So I know that why... I wonder why people are scared.
Oh, yeah.
And what would you say to them to make them not as scared?
Well, you know, I would say it's absolutely normal to be scared. And, you know, this is... You know, it's not the norm for us to be open and honest about our feelings or to focus specifically on difficulties that we're having or, you know, things that are most vulnerable. So the prospect of facing something like that with a person you've never met before and, you know, with the focus of the session being on difficulties, then it can be very nerve-wracking. And I think, you know, if there's no nerves, then that's great. Some people actually feel excited about approaching it sometimes. But I would say every single person I speak to, you know, when I ask how they're feeling and they first come in, it's definitely normal for nerves and, you know, fear. So do not worry about that because it's normal. And if you are approaching therapy, the therapist will be used to that and they will be able to reassure you.
That's cool. Do you feel like you need to maybe see a few before you find your... Do you need a connection both ways, I guess, to be able to help someone and get help?
Definitely. I mean, you know, it can be quite a minefield out there when you're looking for a therapist because they are, you know, you might have seen how many different types of therapy there are and all of this sort of terminologies, and it can be really confusing for people. But research has suggested that the relationship actually is one of the most important things. So I guess as long as the person is sort of trained in or has experience in what you'd like to talk about, that can be important, but also, you know, feeling comfortable with them. You don't have to go in and sit with a person you do not feel comfortable with, because it's about being open and honest and feeling safe and, you know, in that space. So, you know, it's okay if you don't feel comfortable with that person. Definitely try somebody else. If not, and therapists, we won't get sort of offended by that, because not everyone's, you know, your sort of person. So
a bit like hairdressing.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
How the hairdresser change.
Yes, you've got to stay with that
for the
person.
Soul. What sort of questions do you get asked the most? I know we won't go into detail, personal details, but what questions do therapists get asked the most?
So I would say on a general theme, it's, you know, why do I feel like this, you know, or how do I stop feeling like this, you know? And that can be an array of different things. But I think that people get quite frustrated and sometimes scared and overwhelmed by feelings. And we are sort of taught to benefit, you know, the positive feelings are more beneficial, or that they're more accepting in our society. It's more, you know, think positively, you know, feel positive. But sometimes we do have, you know, negative feelings as well, and they are just as valid as positive feelings. So it's about embracing all feelings, I think, not being afraid of them, you know, getting in touch with them, because feelings can't hurt you. And, you know, they're not there to be got rid of, but to maybe work with, to learn from them, to get some insight into what's working in your life and what's not working. Yeah.
I think that's definitely helped me. I think when I came in, I was on this sort of pursuit of, I don't know, I guess happiness and being able just to identify with you, just being, not striving, but just being comfortable is the thing that I think I probably took out of it the most. And now I'm like so much calmer and not as worried and stressed and not striving for something. So, it's very much worth it, and I'd advocate it. If you're feeling like you want to explore those things. And modern day, the modern day life, we're all bombarded with so much. What issues do you see reoccurring from the way we live now?
I would say the most common are definitely anxiety related and stress or depression, you know, but they can all sort of interact with each other like a horrible clique, you know. They all like really sort of encourage each other, and they can overlap as well or make each other worse. But I'd say, you know, out of life balance, you know, definitely with stress. Stress is not a bad thing. You know, it's actually really good for us. It can be very motivational. It can encourage us to reach our goals and to, you know, feel invigorated and sort of engaged in things. But when stress becomes a negative thing, that's when it can cause things like anxiety. And maybe, you know, you've been through a certain life situation which can cause stress, or maybe you're very, very busy, you got too much going on, or actually, you know, you're not focusing enough on other areas of your life. So I would say life balance, it can be a sort of epidemic at the moment for stress related, you know, issues.
Mm. Yeah. So we touched on anxiety there, and anxiety is something that I've talked about. I've struggled with situational anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know what it was until I think I talked it through with you. So I think it'd be great if we could talk about what it is, what are the symptoms and what solutions you can offer to the listeners.
Yeah, definitely. So anxiety, it feels horrible. So understandably, people are, you know, they can be quite scared about it sometimes, or overwhelmed by it, or they want not to have it. But in reality, what anxiety is, it's a very normal part of being a human being. I describe it sometimes as like an internal alarm system and your bouncer, you know, trying to protect you. So that internal alarm system is there for a reason. So we do not want to get rid of anxiety, because otherwise we would have no perception of threat at all. We'd be walking across the road when it's on green, you know, the lights are on green, we'd be walking down dark alleys, you know, we'd be putting ourselves in threatening situations, and therefore potentially dangerous situations. But anxiety can become an issue when we start to, you know, that alarm system starts to go off like a false alarm in situations where, you know, you really do not need it. And I suppose there are some problems with our internal alarm system, because years ago when we were cavemen and women, it was probably really effective, and we were living in a, you know, a dangerous time. We've got wild animals around, and you know, we need that automatic instant response without thinking. You know, it's an automatic response, that fight or flight response, where our body receives hormones to enable us to really get the strength to fight whatever that threat is, or leg it, you know, run away really fast. But the problems we have nowadays, they're more sort of emotional based rather than really physically threatening. So, you know, we can fear criticism, we can fear not being liked by people, we can fear being hurt in a relationship, for example. So the way anxiety can manifest there is that we can become sort of preoccupied with certain specific fears sometimes, or generally not feeling sort of comfortable in life, as though there could be something to worry about. So that could be like a general anxiety. But then there's also, you know, specific anxieties, maybe social anxieties. You've got a lot of names for them, but they are all sort of the same thing, really, feeling fearful of things. And the bad thing about anxiety is you tend to overestimate the threat. So, you know, for example, if it was a, you know, you might fear driving, you overestimate that it's a dangerous thing, there's going to be an accident, for example. And we underestimate our ability to cope in a situation. So maybe I get into an accident and I wouldn't be able to deal with it. You know, I couldn't handle the car. So our thoughts can become sort of biased and irrational, fear-based. And, you know, the way it impacts your body, that fight or flight I mentioned, so that's the physical side of it. You might get sort of heart palpitations, difficulty in breathing, churning stomach, and shaky, dizzy sort of feelings, which keep you in a state of fear, and maybe you don't want to feel like that again. So then that can lead to behaviors of avoiding things, which doesn't help always in life, you know, because you can, like I say, overestimate that threat and then, you know, prevent yourself from growing as a person. So maybe you want to socialize with people, but you think, well, people don't like me, and they probably think I'm an idiot. They probably think, you know, I've said something silly, so I may as well just not do it. So those are just a few sort of general ways that it can impact.
It's broad, isn't it?
You could talk about anxiety like as a, I mean, there are, you know, anxiety just based podcasts, and you could talk about it forever, because the ways it could impact people are so diverse, but it's always, you know, it impacts your thoughts, it impacts you physically, it impacts your behavior. You know, one common thing is also sort of intrusive thoughts that people can get, overthinking. I would say that's like an epidemic now as well. You know, really, really worrying about things and going over and over and over things in your mind. But I call it sort of being living in fear, really, because you can get stuck and really believe in those thoughts and never test it out in reality to see, well, is this actually true?
Yeah. You know? So what would be your tips then if you, I know it's not like specific to one person's situation, but have you got any tips for anxiety?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, in terms of physical, the way it can impact us physically, then the fight or flight response, as I said, that occurs automatically, because if your body senses that you're under threat, even if it's not a real threat, really, that's going to happen. So you're flooded with this adrenaline, cortisol, and you feel awful, really. You know, it's not helpful at all to most situations we have in life now. So one thing you could do is relax breathing techniques. And, you know, there's a couple of different reasons why that's good for you. It's the first one is, you know, you can distract yourself from the situation, the thoughts or whatever situation you might be facing. And, you know, it also gets you back into parasympathetic nervous system, which is like the soothing. It's your friend, basically, if you're feeling panicked or anxious. The sympathetic nervous system is fight or flight. You know, you're ready to engage, you're ready to fight whatever it is. And tense. And then the parasympathetic nervous system is like calming and soothing. So a few minutes of deep breathing, ensuring that you're breathing with your full diaphragm, because we tend to be, you know, all breathing in our chest when we're anxious. Full diaphragm breathing for a few minutes, that can engage the parasympathetic nervous system and calm you down, but also distract you. So breathing, you can take it anywhere with you. And, you know, you can have apps like, you know, Calm and Headspace, and have a little thing you can breathe along to sometimes. Or there's, you know, resources online where you can learn. Sounds a bit silly, you know, learning how to breathe, but, you know, breathing in a deep way to encourage relaxation. So that's for the physical.
Right.
And I love to sort of challenge thoughts. I use quite a few sort of CBT techniques, really, with thoughts, because they are, like I said, one of the most common thing I see with anxiety. So challenging thoughts. Often we can be stuck in that sort of fear trap of, this is what I think about things, and this is what's going to happen. This is definitely going to happen. You know, I'm going to do an exam and I'm going to fail it. You know, it's going to happen. So by challenging the thought, you can ask yourself, you know, how much do I really believe in that? Is this a fact, or is it a fear-based thought? You know, is it an anxiety thought, and my opinion, basically, you know? And if it's fact, then great. You know, if it's a situation you could do something about, then you could plan, you know, how to address that. But if it's just your opinion or a thought, then you maybe just acknowledge and say, okay, that's probably an anxiety, and that's okay, but I don't need to believe in that and allow it to drive my life anymore.
So it's about being conscious to the thoughts.
Yeah, and definitely, you know, do not avoid the thoughts, because they're going to be there anyway. It's like saying, you know, don't think about a pink elephant in the room. It's like, I've got that thought, I'm going to try and ignore it, but it's going to be there anyway. So maybe you could just take charge of it and work with it, really. And, you know, you can also ask evidence-based questions like, this is what I believe about a situation. I believe that nobody likes me, and I probably seem stupid, and everything I say, you know, I sound like an idiot, you know, so I'm not going to go out and socialize with people. Well, you could say, where's the evidence that I'm an idiot? Where's the evidence that people don't like me? And think of anything you could think of that reinforces that. But then you could also say, it's like putting it up in court, really. I say thought in court. So it's on the stand, and you're like, okay, where's the evidence to prove this is, you know, a fact? And where is the evidence that it's not true? And now how do I feel about it?
Great. Well, they're great tips. Yeah. That'll definitely help people.
Yeah.
Shall we move on to the reason why the podcast is here? And I don't know if I said that before, but when we were just trying to decide what to call the podcast, and we said that it should be things that I say to my therapist. And the reason that it has massively mm-hmm. helped me was around my imposter syndrome when I became MD. And we have had, so on the podcast, we get admission submissions from people. Mm-hmm. We've had one from a female aged 25. Yeah. So I'll read it out, but I think it links quite nicely to imposter syndrome. And then we'll talk about the hot topic, because whenever we talk about imposter syndrome, we get so many people say that they feel it.
So and common.
They're glad that we're talking about it. So I'm super happy that you're here. Yeah. To talk about it a bit more scientifically than I am, but also give people tips on how to deal with it. So I'll read the message out, and then we'll talk about imposter syndrome and how to beat the imposter. Yeah. So this is from a female aged 25, and the subject reads, "I shouldn't say this, but I'm bored of my job and I feel I deserve better." Yeah. And then the message reads, "I love listening to the podcast. Thanks. At the moment, I can really relate to everything that gets mentioned, especially with imposter syndrome. I know I'm good at my job, but I'm scared of going somewhere else and failing in a different field. At the moment, I feel that there's one thing holding me back from quitting my job. Oh, that's the one thing holding me back and quitting my job and moving on to something else. I've been full-time in my job for 2 years, and since going full-time, I've jumped two ranks and I am one position away from business stroke store manager." Wow. So they're obviously doing well. "I've been with the company 7 years in total, but previously part-time. And while part-time, I've moved up another three ranks. However, I feel like I've done everything to do with the company I am in, and I'm stuck, as having a business manager under my belt would be great. But I'm getting very bored of the day-to-day and not looking forward going to work. I don't find it challenging or stimulating, and I've done everything I could do within the role except have the title. I'm too scared to just up and leave. And I don't really know what to do with the rest of my life."
This is one of those situations where I can sort of describe as living in fear, and where anxiety or, you know, concern about something is holding you back. And it sounds to me like the evidence suggests that this person is really, really capable and very, you know, good at their job, and hence the evidence, you know, going up in ranks, etc. And that they really like having a challenge, but they're not really enjoying where they are right now, and that's because they're not being challenged anymore. So one of the things I mentioned there was maybe moving into a different field. So you can get sort of uncomfortably comfortable in a situation where this is really, you know, I feel comfortable with this, I know it, so, you know, therefore I feel like I'm good at it. So it's absolutely normal to feel nerves about moving into a new field. But it is not evidence to say that she's not going to be good at it. You know, I think acknowledging those nerves and saying it's normal to feel this way with any new challenge and any step up or change in career, it's going to be nerve-wracking, but we can believe the feeling we have. So the feelings can drive the evidence. So feelings can feel nerve-wracking, so you can feel like, maybe I can't do it. But there's no evidence that I've heard there that this person would not flourish, you know, in a new field as well, just like they have in this one.
Yeah, definitely. I think it does sound like they've got a bit of an imposter there.
Yes.
Shall we talk about imposter syndrome in a bit more detail? Yes. What is imposter syndrome?
So it's not, hence the name, sort of syndrome. It's not a condition at all. It's just an experience that a person can have, basically, where they might feel like an imposter in a certain situation. And it's always when you're in a situation where you can perceive it as successful, or you've done well, so to speak. So it's an unrealistic view of your abilities, really. It's like you're not acknowledging your ability to be in the position that you're in. You're questioning it. Maybe you might believe, oh, this was a fluke, I got here, you know, I got this job because, you know, everybody they interviewed probably wasn't at a good standard, and that's the only reason I'm here. Or, you know, it was luck of the draw, you know, and you'll find any reason not to really own the success. But, you know, by challenging that, if you think about the evidence, like the person just mentioned there, how did I get to the position that I'm in now? What is the evidence as to why I deserve to be here? And you'll probably find that there's a better explanation for it, really. But yeah, it's really, really common thing. And I think, you know, the research says that 70% of people can experience it when they are successful. But I would say, you know, maybe everybody does at some point in their life. You can question yourself and your ability. It can be a good thing to do sometimes, to say, right, do I need any development? You know, do I need to challenge myself more? But it's not reason enough to believe that you're not good enough to be in that position.
Yeah, it gives me a kick up the bum now. Yes. Now when I recognise it, I'm like, that's when I know that I need to, like, I shouldn't be comfortable and I need to give myself a bit of a kick.
Yes, you, and it can also creep in like that, you know, you can overwork yourself, you know, to justify your position, so to speak, because if it doesn't feel hard or like you're not working hard enough, you're like, right, I don't deserve this. I need to be, you know, working really late, challenging myself more. Maybe you'll compare yourself against your peers unfairly and pick out things you like about them or that you perceive to be successful and say, oh, yeah, but everyone around me is like, they deserve to be here and I don't. So I need to, you know, keep challenging myself, keep doing more. So challenging yourself is good, but not to the point where you sort of that slave driver inside for fear of being found out. So that's another sort of characteristic of it. If I put myself out there, I'm going to be found out. So like the person who sent in the submission, if I put myself in a new career, maybe I'm going to be found out that actually I'm not capable of this. You know,
I'm smiling because this is where this all started.
Yeah.
What are the solutions for dealing with your inner imposter?
So again, challenge it. I love challenging it and not allowing it to dictate your life, really, because, you know, using the evidence-based approach, really, saying how much do I really believe that I am not good at my job or I didn't deserve, you know, this outcome, you know, how much do I really believe it? And where is the evidence that I have not worked hard enough or that I'm not capable enough for this, but where is the evidence that I deserve to be here? So really, you know, balancing it out and thinking rationally about things. Maybe having an inner support system as well, actually, because we're very critical of ourselves and we're very quick to be critical of ourselves. And we've got that, you know, the inner slave driver or the inner sort of critic who is commenting on our insecurities or things that we don't like about ourselves or things we think we could improve. But we don't nurture the compassionate side of ourselves very often. So you could almost, you know, create that character of the imposter to detach it from you because it isn't you. Mm. The imposter syndrome is the imposter. It's not you, you know. So you could create that, you know, cheerleader inside and say, right, so when I'm feeling like this, what would somebody say to me if they were encouraging me? What would I say to someone if I was like, come on, you know, you're good enough for this, you deserve it, you've done well, you deserve this success. Allow yourself to have that success, you know?
I think, yeah, because I think we've talked about that. What would you say to a friend if they were in a similar position? And you, the way you talk to yourself is very different to what you'd say to your friend.
We give ourselves such a hard time compared to everybody else. And in reality, you know, we don't deserve it, just as, you know, another person doesn't.
So true, so true. Obviously, we are a social media agency.
Yes.
And I think part of it leads quite nicely after the anxiety and imposter syndrome stuff. Yeah. What are your thoughts on social media?
I think I've got a love-hate relationship with it, to be honest with you. I think it's a really good thing, you know, really good for connecting people, you know, all over the world. Really good to keep friends connected when you're far away, you know. It's really good of keeping messages going, you know, drawing people together, you know, keeping you up to date with things that you're interested in, like events. I really love that side of it too. And, you know, news and information at your fingertips, it's really good. The dark side of it is the comparison trap that, you know, everybody can fall into. We can all fall into that. Or information overload, I would say. So I think social media is, it's a good thing, but we definitely need to sort of monitor our relationship with that. You know, noticing if we are comparing ourselves to other people, because we generally only see the good news on social media. You know, we're not telling everybody often about our day-to-day struggles or, you know, all of the really mundane stuff in life. We want people to see, you know, the memories, the successes. So what can happen there is you can get a biased view of everybody's life. It's like everybody else is having the best time ever, looking their best, you know, and enjoying life. And I'm sat here, you know, in reality at the other side of a screen, and I'm living a normal life. And but just knowing that everybody is in the same position, you know, their successes and best bits are not the everyday either.
I saw a great Instagram post this morning from one of the girls in the team that said the grass isn't always green, that they've probably just used a filter.
Absolutely. I like that.
That is brilliant. That sums it up perfectly.
Absolutely.
That the grass isn't always greener. Yeah. They've probably just used a filter. Yeah. But the information overload stuff's quite interesting, because I think there's a lot of talk about comparison, but probably not as much about the information overload.
Yeah. I mean, you know, because we've got so much information at our fingertips, I think it, you know, it's definitely a good thing, but, you know, we can be mindlessly scrolling through our screens right throughout the day. It's like an automatic thing. You don't even notice you're doing it sometimes. It's like, oh, I'll go on Facebook or I'll go on. And so you're scrolling through all of this information. And sometimes it can be information which is quite, you know, upsetting as well, or news that can be quite upsetting. And so, you know, we're exposed to all of these you know, scary news stories or things that have happened in the world, and it's always the really catastrophic stuff. So we can get a biased view of what the world is like as well, that the world is negative, that it's somewhere to worry about, I'm at risk and so is everyone else. But the world is, you know, it is getting safer, but we just know more about what's going on now. So I think you can get overwhelmed by the information that you scroll through, and maybe monitoring and deciding what information you want to read, or, you know, researching what you need to know, or monitoring how long you spend on social media.
Okay, so we should all be watching what we're reading and how much. Okay, cool. That's what I'm going to do after this. I would like to just move on to the benefits of seeing a counsellor or a therapist, because it's obviously sometimes you don't know that you would benefit from it. I think I was a little bit in that bracket. And then as soon as we started talking, it was like, there's quite a lot actually that you just don't realise. So how, what are the benefits? And also, how do you, like, who should see a therapist, and how do you know when's the time?
Yeah, so I think it's absolutely normal, like I said, to have loads of different feelings, including negative ones. So embracing all feelings. But when the feelings or thoughts or behaviours start to impact your life, for example, if it was anxiety and you're overthinking to the point where you're really worrying and it's getting in the way of your everyday life, or you're avoiding situations that, you know, could, you know, benefit you or help you grow, or your feelings are very, very overwhelming, then when it's getting in the way of your day-to-day life, then that is a good time to sort of seek help. And you don't have to be in the depths of despair, you know, to go and speak to somebody. It's actually a really good time when you start to notice that it's having an impact on your life, because you're in a better frame of mind to be able to make changes and work with these issues and see things more rationally, and not be so clouded by feelings. So it's definitely a good time to do it when impacting your life. And I would say, you know, just having somebody to talk to, you know, to be heard is a very powerful thing. And of course, in therapy, it's you're unconditionally positively regarded, we call it. So you can just be you, and, you know, you will not be judged at all. You can come as you are, so to speak. And that person will, you know, help to nurture your true self. And you know, there's no risk of being judged. So you can say all of the things that are on your mind, and it's quite a cathartic experience. So, you know, that sense of getting it off your chest can be, you know, releasing a burden or a weight from your shoulders. And definitely having another perspective on things is a good thing, because we can get tangled up in our own head sometimes with those different thought processes, the unhelpful thought patterns we can get into. We can really convince ourselves of a different reality. So having someone, you know, speak you know, and present it back to you in different ways with different perspectives can be really good.
Yeah.
And that also help you to find ways of coping, you know, so or to make positive changes in your life.
So the way it works is that we'd talk, wouldn't we? And then you'd help me see the picture.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You don't actually tell me what to do.
No.
Which is probably something to say. You just help me understand where it's coming from and why.
Absolutely.
And then I can come up with my own solution.
That's right, yeah. I see it as quite a collaboration, really. And there's no sort of power in the room, even though the therapist is there, you know, with training, so to speak. The person is the expert on themselves, really. So I really believe that that person knows what is best for them. And so as the therapist, you work with them to, like a collaboration, to get to the point where they would like to be or where things would feel better. And so it's not providing information or telling a person what to do. It's actually empowering the person to find solutions for themselves that are right for them. And, you know, yeah, because we can get into the trap of, you know, what should I be doing, so to speak? You know, well, this is what I think I should be doing, but is it really right for you? You know, so you get challenged in therapy as well on some of the thought processes and things you might have learned about yourself or the world.
And I think that was one of the real reasons that I benefited so much from it was the fact that I knew it was like a safe environment where I wasn't, because you can ask your friends for advice and as much as they are amazing, the response you get back always has their opinion and bias, doesn't it?
A preconceived idea. And there's no preconceived ideas with therapy. It's like a blank canvas. You know, you are taken as you are and, you know, as you present yourself. And you can, you know, you don't have to talk about things that are too overwhelming for you. You know, just because you're at therapy, you don't have to tip out everything that is the most stressful thing or the worst things you've been through. Take it at your pace and whatever feels right to you. And, you know, it would be the person's choice as to what they focus on each session. So you'll never be, or you shouldn't be in a position where you feel like you're talking about stuff which is quite damaging to you as well, because taking it at the person's pace is also important.
So what does a typical session look like for those that haven't been?
Yeah, so basically you always begin with a consultation, or I do at least, you know, and it's nice to break the ice. So before you meet the person, they can sort of get a feel for who you are. They can ask you questions. You know, you can get a feel for what the problem is or what the difficulties are that they are experiencing. And, so really, you know, finding out what the person needs from the sessions and, you know, explain a bit about it and what to expect. And then, you know, you'll have a contract. So you have a therapeutic agreement between you, which is really important to set boundaries. And of course, everything is confidential. So the person knows that, you know, everything is contained in that safe space and it's trust. Sometimes I offer for people to add something into their contract if they would like me, you know, because it's between us both, what person can expect from me and what I can expect from them, so our agreement together. And then as you go into the sessions, you know, maybe you'll have an idea about what you want to focus on to start with. The person might, you know, talk about a lot of different things given the sort of general background, and that's okay, you know, getting to know how everything is interlinking. And then as you go through, maybe they'll drill down into more specific situations and decide what topic they want to focus on each day. And, you know, you monitor things together to see how the person is doing. You'd never hold a person in therapy for longer than they need to. That's not good. You know, it's empowering the person to provide them with tools and to feel better, to go back out, you know, into the world and empower themselves, really. So it's a fine line between the person not finishing therapy too soon, but, you know, not for too long.
And we've gone, haven't we? We started, I think it was once a week, and then we went down to ad hoc sessions. Mm-hmm. Then we went back to once a week for a little bit. And then now now I'm not on your register. I'll just pop in when I need you. How do you know how often you should be seeing a therapist?
Yeah, so to begin with, it is recommended weekly. And the reason for that is consistency, really. So yeah, it might feel difficult to begin with to attend, especially if the person is really struggling, but it's still important to attend and share that space. So consistency weekly is a good thing, you know. On the odd occasion, someone might need more than that, you know, but yeah, weekly. And then as things pan out, you know, as you mentioned, you know, that maybe the sessions get extended, and it's always a good sign if the person comes in, they're sort of like, I don't know what to talk about today. I don't really know what to talk about. But sometimes they can be like, you know, I didn't know what I wanted to talk about, and I can't believe that, you know, I've spoken about so much today. So it's getting to know what the need is, and does the person really need these sessions anymore? So you do a review and say, okay, where did you come from? What did you need from the sessions? How far along do you feel you are? What's left over? Has anything changed? You know, what are the risks going forward? Do you feel like, you know, it might be risky to end? Things like that. So it's about reviewing it too.
Yeah, and I think I've spoken to a few people who've been to initial sessions, and I think that keeping that consistency is really important, isn't it? Because well, if you've not been before, and then you open up boxes that you've had closed for a long time, it can feel very painful after that first session, can't it?
So I think that's a good thing to mention as well, actually, that sometimes after a session, you might feel bad, you know, you might feel upset, because if you've been focusing on memories or certain feelings, you can feel upset. But equally so, you could feel like a weight's been lifted and, you know, I'm walking on air. So and it can change week to week. Maybe at the beginning, it's more overwhelming, understandably. Like you mentioned, people can be scared at the start, and you're sort of finding out, is this OK? You know, am I safe here? You know. And then hopefully the person will feel more and more comfortable.
But it's about sticking with it, isn't
it?
Yes. So knowing that it might hurt, but you're going to work through it and figure out the best way to get around it.
Yeah, and you've got somebody there supporting you as well through it. So it's something about, you know, sharing and having that support there as well. You know, I'm facing this, I'm talking about things, I'm getting through this, but I've also got someone who's got my back too.
Yeah. Oh, it's so good. It is. I can't recommend it highly enough. Honestly, it's so good. What is something that you think we could all be doing to help improve our mental health?
Yeah. Well, I like to sort of view mental health quite holistically, to be honest, because we are like, you know, I use this sort of example of being like a cake recipe or a recipe sometimes, where, you know, if you were a cake and you'd have a lot of different ingredients, so to speak, to keep, you know, to bake the perfect cake. So maybe I like cake too much. That's probably what I'm thinking. But
I just thought of pink yes, cake. And fancy. I don't think that was just what I would be.
So typical of me, sweet stuff. But yeah, like, you know, you've got sleep, so important for mental health. You know, lack of sleep or difficulty sleeping can be enough to knock your mental health off kilter and cause anxiety or depression. So it's getting enough sleep, getting enough rest, you know, work, having, you know, enough time in work and feeling satisfied at work, connections with friends, with family, with hobbies, with yourself, just being you. And so you could have a little think about, if you were to write your name in the middle of a page, for example, and say, well, right, this is me. And what are all the components that make up me in my life? You know, what's important to me to make me feel content or balanced in life? And so you can consider all of those things. And then, you know, if you're feeling a bit out of balance sometimes or a bit stressed, and you can have a look and say, well, is anything suffering here? Am I, you know, being a slave to work and I've not seen friends for long enough? Or, you know, do I need some exercise? You know, because exercise is really, really good, you know, really good for mental health. You know, you don't all need to be, you know, in the gym or doing things that everyone's doing on Instagram, but finding something that works for you, you know, walking, running, you know, I really advocate exercise as well as part of staying balanced.
I think this has come out actually as the podcast series has gone on. It's like knowing yourself and your values.
Yes. Oh, yeah, definitely.
And I think both
what's important to you,
work and privately as well, is knowing what you value the most.
Definitely.
And then you can navigate your life into places that you would
Absolutely.
Want to be.
Definitely. And I think there's something about that as well, where oftentimes you can be living a life which you think you are supposed to be living, or I'm supposed to be doing this because my peers are doing it, or my parents said I should be doing it, or Instagram is telling me I should be doing this or looking like this. And actually, if you ask the question, is this right for me? You know, what do you actually want to do? Because we can get caught up in what we should be doing. But it does not create happiness if it's not the right thing for you. So embracing your individuality and, you know, what is important to you and your values, you can't go far wrong with that, really.
I need to do my values. That's
You can do sort of values exercises in therapy and, you know, sometimes you don't know what's important to you. I think that's okay as well. Maybe you haven't thought about it before, but spending some time getting to know yourself like a friend, you know, if I met me for the first time, how would I describe me? What would I say? What's important to me? Or what did I used to enjoy as a child? You know, to get to know yourself.
I'm going to come in and do that with you. And I think finally, are there any good books or people that... you could recommend if someone's thinking about therapy? Is there anything that you would recommend as a starting point?
Yeah, I would say, you know, if you're looking for a therapist, there's some good therapist listings called, the first one is the Counselling Directory, and there's Psychology Today. And these are all, you know, qualified therapists who are part of a governing body. So they're reputable people, and you can search for the particular issue you wanted to focus on and your area. So have a little look through. There'll be a picture of them, hopefully, as well, and a bit of a description. You can get a feel for what you think. So that's quite a good starting place if you're wanting to look for a therapist in your area. And in terms of books, I particularly like, it's a CBT-based book series, but that they're very, you know, practical. They can give you sort of explanations about particular issues and also ways to deal with it as well. So they're sort of empowering you with the information and understanding about things, but then, you know, being able to work with them and challenge sort of things. So it's the Overcoming series. So there's things like Overcoming Depression, Overcoming low self-esteem, Overcoming Anxiety, Overcoming Worry, and they can be quite good. But yeah, there's so many good books around, which are obviously different modalities, and everyone is different. There's not one size fits all. If you don't like the sound of a book or it's not working for you, then just definitely keep looking for something else.
And there's one question that I didn't have on my list that I just thought. We obviously found you and we use you as social chain, as our counsellor, what benefits do you think companies would get from having that approach to mental health?
Yeah, I think it's an amazing approach. I was really excited to work with, Social Chain when I was looking at, you know, the company and the approach to mental health and the values that you sort of live by. I was like, this is great. You know, it really feels like I would fit with this. So, as a company, you really, really embrace mental health and acknowledge it and actually try to assist employees. So that's a good thing. And I think it's quite a forward thinking way of being. So any company who really acknowledges mental health and brings it into the forefront, like we would physical health, for example, you know, you get your colleagues might be sat there going, oh gosh, I've got man flu, or, you know, I had a headache. And it's very normal to talk about that. But the more normal it becomes to talk about and address mental health, the more people will feel able to address problems. So providing those opportunities like Social Chain, maybe. A business could use an EAP service, for example. So and that's like an insurance. And, you know, if the employee needs some sessions, then they can call upon the organisation. But yeah, I'd say addressing mental health really impacts the performance as well. You know, stress levels, and, you know, if you're struggling with mental health, then it's definitely going to impact on all areas of your life, including performance at work. And, you know, the leading cause of absence at work is, you know, anxiety and depression. So it can be quite a surprise to hear that, you know, it's not flu or man flu or headaches or a physical ailment. It's actually related to mental health struggles. So it could only be a good thing if all employers were, you know, encouraging mental health support.
Wow, I did not know that.
Yeah.
So, companies out there need to think about it. Mm. because it'll make such a big difference. We notice a massive difference. People are just so much happier in work and in their life, and that has a big impact on what we can achieve. But I just want to say, personally, thank you so much for everything that you have done for me.
It's my pleasure.
I don't think I would be in the position I am now if it wasn't for you. And I also want to say a massive thank you for coming on the podcast.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me. This is a first for me. So me putting myself out of my comfort zone as well. So, yes.
You're an absolute natural, Karen. And I'm sure we'll have you back.
I think I'm just a chatterbox.
Yeah. That's what it's all about. Yeah. But yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks. Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. Thank you.